This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
So far away, my London friends said, when I went to work in wild Moscow. So far away, my Moscow friends said, when I headed south across Russia on trips to the wilder Caucasus. The mountains Fitzroy MacLean called the end of all the earth. So far away, my friends in the Caucasus said, when I started planning a visit to a city that lay beyond the end of the mountains, beyond Chechnya, right down by the grey, oily Caspian Sea, Makhachkala. And some went so far as to add, are you crazy? Makhachkala is not exactly a tourist destination. In fact, if you look the city up online, you'll find that all Wikitravel says about it is, don't go, please. In a little red box right at the top of the page, there's a raised hand in a circle and warning in bold. Travel to Makhachkala is extremely dangerous in bold and strongly discouraged. There are no tips for restaurants and museums and hotels. The rest of the page is blank. So why would anyone go to Makhachkala? It's the capital of a remote Muslim region on the southeastern fringe of Russia. The Russian papers have always represented Dagestan as the primitive badlands where anything might happen, from mudslides to collapsing mountain tunnels and grim, grasping corruption in business and political elites. Nowadays, there's also the geographical curse of the Chechen War, rebellious thoughts and religious radicalism seeping over the border in a low-level Islamic insurgency and a heavily armed fight-back from the security services. That's the badness coming down from the mountains. And there's nothing better coming from the sea on the other side of town. Just a trade in illegal caviar from sturgeon, poached out of the Caspian. I went because I wanted to write a book about the crooked caviar business. I needed to find some smugglers to interview, to find out what about the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 had made them turn in such numbers to a new life of crime. But I went not expecting to like the place, even for a Caucasus junkie, as I was at the end of the 90s. The city itself isn't billed as somewhere you'd specially want to get to know or want to go. If it's the mountains you want, which are breathtakingly beautiful, full of heroic warrior history, eagles, waterfalls, astonishing peaks and valleys and religious shrines, there's no need to linger in town. You can head straight off from the nearby airport. While Chechnya was in the headlines, this airport was one of several places that journalists could land from Moscow before driving on west to the war zone. But it was the longest way there, and none of the hacks who actually went into the city seemed to come back singing its praises. Unkempt, they said. Breeze block housing estates, traffic jams, tired admin buildings, and no history to speak of either. The city, which now has 500,000 inhabitants, grew out of a fort built by Russian soldiers in an earlier war in the 19th century. It was quite hard to even find a photographer willing to share the trip to Makhachkala. What caviar story could be thrilling enough, all the tough, strapping men kept saying, to compensate for the risk of extortion or kidnapping or killing? In the end, an American woman agreed to go to what we were both already nervously calling Dagestan, after the local weapon of choice. Every fear we flew in with seemed confirmed on our first night. We stayed in a hotel on a central street roaring with rusty, dilapidated, angry traffic. The surly cashier who checked us in did so from inside a metal cage, with a man with a gun beside him. There were bars on all the flaking windows. And after a twitchy, sleepless night, which we blamed on mosquitoes, we took away our bags in the morning. And then things changed. It was a hot, summery, sweet Saturday. As we went to meet our first interviewee, we found ourselves wandering under swaying trees through sunlit parks among a happy weekend crowd in headscarves and embroidered skullcaps. We were struck by the holiday atmosphere. People eating ice cream, people selling gimmicky trinkets, and clouds of kebab smell wafting out from the tatty cafes, which even today are still painted in the innocent pastel colours that tourists in the Soviet Union were always supposed to like. We went to see the Grand Mosque, a new attraction being built with Turkish money on the city's main avenue. They say it's made to the pattern of the Sultan Ahmed Mosque in Istanbul. It can hold 17,000 worshippers. Its dome and minarets are ringed in zingy green and white neon. On our first day in Mahachkala, it was getting a gleaming outer cladding of white marble. Three old ladies hung proudly round outside, telling us about it. They had wrinkled faces, grinning fit to bust under their headscarves. Their hands and arms and necks were freckled with the funny little village tattoos, dots and moons and backward swastikas drawn on like biro marks, which you see in the mountains, and which are supposed to date back to the time of Alexander the Great, and maybe before. A woman who had once taught atheism, but now devoutly wore a white headscarf, stopped and gave it to me. The one I'd put round my shoulders was, as it turned out, the wrong colour. I bought a green book of prayers from a street stall, whose title, in mock Arabic writing, was How to Ward Off the Evil Eye. The kebabs in the street cafes were unremarkable, but I soon made friends with the journalists who'd been helping me find interviewees. Their families, gentle university teachers in cosy flats, couldn't have been more hospitable. They fed me. On that first trip, they helped us find a better hotel. On my later trips, they put me up. They explained how things worked down here, how the different ethnic groupings each had their own language but had communicated under the Tsars in the Turco-Tatar of the valley traders, and later, now, in Russian, how they'd kept things peaceful with a Swiss-style government system in which the different ethnicities rotated in and out of the local presidency, almost unnoticed by the man in the street. They talked affectionately about the traditions of matchmaking, carpet weaving, and bride stealing. They drove me round, gave me books, went travelling with me, showed me how to dance the lezginka, and took me to weddings. Before I knew what was happening, I found I'd fallen for the shabby charm of the place, enough that I started finding excuses to go back. And what's more, when people asked me what I was doing there, I'd sometimes say, tourism, just to see the surprise on their faces. It wasn't that there turned out to be no crime in Mahachkala. It was easy enough to find caviar smugglers. In fact, I sometimes felt, as I wrote my book, that half the city was somehow tied up with the caviar business. Ex-military engineers canned consignments of it under the vines in their courtyards. Neatly suited ex-bank clerks went fishing for it for 10 times their old salaries. Everyone involved thought it was a bit of a laugh that they, personally, were doing so well, even though life as they'd known it before had been swept away by the Soviet collapse. No one knew how the stuff they needed got to them, or where it went afterwards. No one knew who made the payments. No one took any blame for the deaths of fish or of people. Everyone just quietly took as much money as they could and thanked their lucky stars. Even though there is no visible legal source of wealth in Dagestan, there are plenty of people who've got very rich since the end of the Soviet Union. In fact, there's now an entire district of fantasy soap opera mansions featuring jacuzzis and helicopter pads and wildly overwrought ironwork. An area known mockingly by the people who can't afford to live there as Santa Barbara. But if the rewards of success seemed high, so did the risks. My journalist friends kept my eyes popping with their stories of drive-by shootings, suspicious suicide leaps, and mysterious explosions. I rushed into the nice solid bathroom and lay on the floor. It took me ages to realise it wasn't an earthquake. My nerve gave out, in the end. The crime story in my book came to seem just a smaller version of the crime story in Moscow, though with exotic local colouring. It was about the transfer of assets on a massive scale, usually barely legal and often with violence, from the state to private hands, sometimes courtesy of people who'd been state representatives. It was depressing to feel so helpless and tongue-tied, confronted by the continual threat. So I went back to England. There are now moves afoot to make us see Makhachkala in a more positive light. Dagestan's one internationally successful local boy-turned-billionaire has bought the football team and is packing it with international superstars, including the Brazilian legend Roberto Carlos and the Cameroonian striker Samuel Eto'o, who's believed to be the highest-paid footballer in the world. Suleiman Kerimov is said to have spent getting on for £200 million on players and £100 million on the stadium, and is ready to throw hundreds of millions more at this project. There's just one catch. Makhachkala's too dangerous for rich foreigners. So the team lives and trains 1,000 miles north of Dagestan, just outside Moscow. The streets of Makhachkala are full of football posters. But whenever there's what is loosely known as a home fixture, the home team players fly down by private jet for the day, then go back to Moscow afterwards. I wish them luck. I miss my friends from Makhachkala. I enjoy remembering their laughter, their grace under pressure, and the many small acts of bravery in their lives. And I still like knowing that there's more to the story than the bloody events of the headlines. But I was glad to leave. I doubt sport, even on this lavish scale, can alter the reality. If you have the choice, you're better off somewhere else. It would take more than a football match to tempt me back there now.